Transportation Workforce Development for Wednesday. We'll begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2580. Janet.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2580 came to you with a House vote of 53-0, and it would is at the request of Representative Patty Smith, and would abolish the Western Oregon Onion Commission.
Coward.
Thank you. You know, again, this is another effort to streamline government, and if onions make you cry, this bill will really make you cry. And now, and here to tell us why he would like us to abolish him is Mr. Andrews.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Western Oregon Onion Commission.
Oh, please identify yourself. I know you've been out of government for a while, but you remember the rally.
Bruce Andrews, 3228 Journey Court, Westland, Oregon, Administrator of Western Oregon Onion Commission. Mr. Chairman, thank you for hearing this bill. The Western Oregon Onion Commission is a small group of Western Oregon onion growers who for years have marketed or tried to brand a specialty of red onions into the international marketplace. They've been quite successful, and in fact, probably 50% of their product ends up in Japan. But over the years, the number of growers and the number of acreage has shrunk from a high of about 5,000 acres now down to less than 800 acres. And this is just only in Western Oregon. Obviously, onions are raised all over Oregon, probably about 3,200 acres. And with that in mind, it was no longer cost effective to maintain and run a commission. There's probably less than 12 growers on that 800 acres. So with that in mind, we thought it was time to revert back to a voluntary association, which they were before they became a commission.
Well, thank you. So what are they planting now? Corn and ethanol business now?
I suspect that most of the other acreage have gone into more high-value nursery crops, mm-hmm. specifically.
Okay, questions for Mr. Andrews before we abolish him. Well, thank you so much for taking
thank
the time
you.
To come. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2580, open a work session on House Bill 2580 to abolish the Western Oregon Onion Commission.
I move House Bill 2580 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2580 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I'll carry that. We'll ask Senator Deckert to be excused on this one, unless he shows up with a burning desire and he can appeal the onion vote. We will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 984. Janet.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 984 would make loans that finance construction, development, or acquisition of manufactured dwelling parks eligible for affordable housing tax credits. It would require that the housing continue to be operated as a manufactured dwelling park for the period for which the tax credit is allowed. The bill would also, at the top of page 2, line 6, make loans that finance acquisition of affordable housing eligible for affordable housing tax credits. Right now, that's limited to construction and rehabilitation or development, and this makes it clear that acquisition is also included. The bill also increases the cap on the allowable tax credits from $11 to $13 million for fiscal year 08-09 and for up to $15 million for future fiscal years. The bill would take effect 91 days after adjournment, and you also have a dash one amendment at your place, and this would make loans that finance preservation of affordable housing eligible for affordable housing tax credits.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Van Landingham, Mr. Hanley, and Ms. McLennan.
I have that right.
First three people have signed up. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Van Landingham. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. I'm here on behalf of the Housing Alliance, which is the requester of 984 and the Dash 1 amendments. What 984 does, as Janet described, is to amend the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. It's a tax credit which the legislature adopted in 1989. so it's been around for a while. It allows Oregon banks to take a credit against taxes equivalent to the value in the reduction of its interest rates on affordable housing development loans up to 4 points. In other words, what it does is allow a bank to lend for affordable housing development at 4 percentage points below normal commercial interest rates. So if the market interest rate on a loan is 7 or 8%, the bank can lend at 3 or 4%, take the difference in the loss as it's credited against taxes. This is a hugely significant tool, it has been since 89, for affordable housing development. It's something that other states have looked at trying to copy. It's significant for two big reasons. The obvious one, cheaper money for building affordable housing projects. That allows us, in many cases, to build projects that we wouldn't be able to build otherwise. And I have two builders on my left and my right who are going to talk about this some more. Developers of affordable housing. Also the lower rents on the projects that we develop. But the second is not so obvious. It leverages private money. It entices banks to lend on developments, affordable housing developments, that they would not otherwise lend on. And as an example, there is the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing. It's a nonprofit consortium of 21 Oregon banks formed in 1990. I've been on the board since 1991. And during that time, NOAA has made more than 114 loans all over the state, urban and rural, worth $123 million in private money for more than 4,600 affordable housing units with a value, a development cost of more than $440 million. So the OHTC is significant in getting that private money into these projects. What 984 would do is to allow the use of this important tool on two other problems that face the state. If you haven't heard about, you will hear more about as we go through. One is the closure of manufactured housing parks, and the other one is preservation of projects that can convert, federally subsidized projects that can convert to market, and we will lose them from the affordable housing supply. Martha's going to talk about that one. Peter's going to talk about manufactured housing parks. It also, finally, raises the cap on the allowable credit per year from $11 million now to $13 million and then to $15 million in 2010. We view this as somewhat of an experiment. Addressing the park closure issue is incredibly complicated. Addressing the preservation issue is incredibly complicated. We expect HCS, which administers Housing Media Services, which administers the tax credit program, to do no more than two or three of each of these projects in the next biennium. Will give us a chance to see whether this works as a tool to help preserve mobile home parks and preservation projects. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, will you go ahead and have all three speak first?
Good afternoon, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. My name is Peter Heenley. I'm Executive Director of CASA of Oregon, based in Newburgh, Oregon. We're a 501c3, and over the last 20 years, we've developed about 1,000 units of affordable housing. Probably 30 to 40% of those have used the Affordable Housing Tax Credit. Primarily, we're a developer of housing for agricultural workers. We've recently expanded into doing other low-income populations throughout the state. CASA received a grant from Oregon Housing Community Services as well as from a national nonprofit called CFED to assist residents in purchasing their parks and owning and operating them themselves. We have a number of objectives under the grants from those two sources. We're looking at evaluating various methods of preserving the parks under resident ownership. We're using New Hampshire Community Loan Fund as a model. We're also going to select one or more mobile home parks, depending on a willing seller, at a rate that we can afford to convert those parks to resident ownership. And then we're establishing a collaborative of interested parties to continue this process into the future so that we can hopefully get to the point where we're preserving five parks a year. CASA also works with another funding source, United States Department of Agriculture Rural Development Program, which develops projects throughout the state in rural areas for affordable housing. And these serve primarily low-income people, primarily very low-income people. We're now working with nonprofits and housing authorities to try and preserve these projects, which most of them are currently in private ownership. There's about 200 units throughout rural Oregon, and they represent about 5,200 units. The average income of the people living in these was in 2006 was $9,561. And predominantly, these units are all low-income families, most of them very low-income families. And there's a large number of seniors, female head of households, as well as disabled people that call these units home. We're anticipating that over the next 5 to 10 years, 75 to 80% of these are going to request prepayment, thereby exiting the subsidized housing stock. The federal government no longer supports the preservation, or if they do, it's on a very limited basis. There's currently 40 owners who are wishing to prepay, and we need some structure to assist those folks in negotiating with nonprofits and with housing authorities. The Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits is one of those ways by which we could preserve these units. I just want to urge the committee to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome. Good afternoon. My name is Martha McLennan. I'm the Executive Director of Northwest Housing Alternatives. We're a nonprofit affordable housing developer with offices in Milwaukee. We have affordable housing properties in 14 counties in the state, including most of your districts, not quite all, but most. I want to speak today to the preservation component of this bill, or the amendment that would add that to the bill. Peter has talked very eloquently about the USDA properties. There are also a series of properties that had financing or financial assistance from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. Fundamentally, these properties were developed with this financing 30 years ago, roughly, and made a 30-year commitment to maintain affordability. At the end of that time, the owner has a few different choices that they can make. They can extend their contract with HUD and continue to have the affordability. They can sell the property as a preservation property to another owner who would be willing to maintain that affordability, or they can convert these properties on the open market. When they look at converting the properties, they could continue them as rental properties, simply raising the rents and displacing the existing tenants, or they could also consider condominium conversions. We're looking at a portfolio of these properties right now for acquisition. It's 6 properties. One of the things that's very important to note with these properties is they tend to be very small. The 6 properties that we're looking at have range from 20 units to 50 units. And they need to be packaged very carefully to make sure that you can do an acquisition. I've provided a handout. I'm not sure it got handed out yet. It did. Okay. That helps to illustrate how the OHTC can help these projects. Fundamentally, what you see is the 2 columns without OHTC and with OHTC. The bottom line on the column without the OHTC is a financing gap of over $2 million on a project that's got 100 units. What the OHTC does for you is significantly reduce your debt service costs, meaning that you can increase the amount of financing that comes to the project in the form of debt rather than equity or grants. So it's a very important source. We really want to appreciate the committee and the legislature for considering this. In Oregon, there are thousands and thousands of units that are at risk. The number that I'd heard is 7,000 units that are at risk in the next 3 or 4 years, over 10,000 of these HUD units that are at risk over a longer time frame. At the same time that we're looking at new financing of affordable housing, we need to think about how to maintain our investment in the stock that has already affordable housing. A new development could cost easily twice as much as preserving these affordable stocks. So it's a good investment to be looking at preservation. It's also a significant number of units. Over the history of the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations, the nonprofit statewide that do affordable housing, we have produced just over 10,000 units. We're now looking at an inventory of 10,000 units that could be lost. We need to make sure that we continue to make ground on affordable housing, and preservation is an important component of that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So we're raising the cap. The current cap is $11 million under this program to a 13, and then it would jump to $15 million in 2010, which is why it will be going to Senator Deckert, Finance and Revenue Committee, from here. Questions from the committee for this group of panelists? Senator George.
Thank you. Peter, you and I had a conversation, I think, about this before, but I panel generally. It seems like to me that you're talking about a fairly major problem in the state of Oregon, which is affordable housing. It's much bigger than this right here. And I'd like to get, I have my own thoughts of why this is happening, but I'd like to get your thoughts on, if we're talking about thousands of units being lost, clearly in this state there is a problem with high rate growth in this. When I was growing up in California as a child, I lived in an area where about 90% of my schoolmates were Hispanic migrant workers, and they lived out on the farms in areas where it was really easy with temporary housing that's set up. And those kind of things obviously aren't allowed under a lot of our land use laws and things like that. Costs are going up. And I would like, from your perspective, to give me some understanding why you think the housing prices are going up so fast that it's squeezing out our most in need out of the housing market. Because I think this is key. This is a state policy that we've set up that is hurting our poorest of the poor, and I don't think that conversation has gone on. But I'd like to get a perspective from the three of you, if I could.
Senator Metzger, Senator George, I should reveal before I answer your question that I am the current chair of the Land Conservation and Development Commission and have served on LCDC for 7 years, chair for 3 years. So some might say it's my fault.
I wasn't trying to imply that. Not directly,
some might
anyway.
Say that. I have followed this issue for a long time. I am an affordable housing advocate, which is why I'm here on this bill, and I first got involved in land use planning because I'm an affordable housing advocate and have been for 30 years. I believe that urban growth boundaries do have an impact on the cost of land. It's a supply and demand issue. You restrict the supply, you're going to increase the cost of a product. I'm not an economist, but I've heard economists say those things, and it makes sense to me. I don't believe it's the primary cause of the high cost of housing in Oregon. I think it's because we're a wonderful place to live, and a lot of people want to live here. And a lot of those people have money and will pay whatever it takes. We probably all have friends or acquaintances who moved here from California after cashing out and are paying very high prices for land. I can say to you that LCDC and DLCD have been working very hard for the last several years to make it easier and more efficient for cities to expand their urban growth boundaries to add land. But even where you add land, large amounts of land, as Metro has in the last several years for residential development, the cost to service that land is humongous. And we don't have a way to pay for that since Measure 50 and 5 passed. So it's not a simple one-for-one thing. I believe if you took away the land use program, you would not suddenly have affordable housing. Now, I would also say to you that LCDC and DLCD submitted a bill this session, 187, I think is the number, which would allow easier expansions of UGBs for affordable housing, including new manufactured housing parks. I don't believe that bill is going to get out of the legislature. I think partly because we all want to see what happens with the Big Look and see whether the Big Look can suggest things to the 09 session, which will help. I believe we'll be back in 09, assuming I'm still on LCDC, and we'll ask the legislature to rethink that issue again.
If I could quickly follow up. One of the things, I guess, and Peter, this was more directed towards conversations about some of our poorest of the poor are migrant laborers, regardless of race or whatever. And one of the things I guess I was saying is that we also have some restrictions on what kind of temporary housing can be put up in rural areas. And to me, this could be a really advantageous thing, is to make that process as easy as possible for some flexibility in the rural areas, especially for more migrant communities. So we're not talking about warehousing people in urban areas who work in rural areas, have those commute issues, those costs of the commute issues, and it seems like to me there would be a number of farmers who would be willing to pay for some of the infrastructure to go in. It's more of a flexibility of use in the rural areas that I guess is what I'm trying to get at. It seems to me that we're butting up against that, especially in our working poor that work in more rural type industries. If you discuss, any of you guys discuss, it'd be helpful.
Sure.
So, I guess one thing I would comment, in Clackamas County, you need to earn more than twice the minimum wage to be able to afford an average two-bedroom apartment. So the stress is on in lots of different respects and for lots of different families. I don't think it really is simply the lowest wage earners or the temporary workers in the community that are struggling with affordable housing at this point. I share probably John Van Landingham's belief that while the urban growth boundary is a component piece of it, there are a lot of other component pieces of it. The increasing price of materials, particularly in the last couple of years, the increasing land costs are certainly a significant piece of it. The development and design standards that are imposed in communities that we want to build in, all of those things do contribute to the cost. In states that don't have urban growth boundaries, we see appreciation in property values related to the demand in the marketplace. So if you look at Phoenix that doesn't have an urban growth boundary, its housing prices have paced Oregon's in many respects, or Portland's in many respects, despite that difference in the regulation on the land use. So I think I would agree. It is a piece. It is not the only piece. There are a lot of different pieces to it. As a developer, things that I experience that add to costs, parking ratios for properties with people who have special needs or who are seniors, where I might need to build a 1.5 parking places in a project per person or per unit in a project where I expect, you know, 25, 35, 45% of the population to even own a car. So there are a lot of different components that contribute.
If I could clarify a little bit, Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess I wasn't trying to get into the urban growth boundary issue at all. What I'm really trying to get at is what Peter works on, which is more of the migrant housing. I don't know why I'm not making myself clear. What I'm saying is that there are certain populations that are here on a temporary basis, mm-hmm. that if we allowed some flexibility in other areas and flexibility in siting housing for those folks, it would take pressure off of folks inside the urban growth boundary, because we wouldn't be bringing those people in for a seasonal period of time. They take up housing inside of an urban growth boundary with an apartment, then are gone during the Christmas season or whatever. And I guess I'm asking for a general discussion of what we're facing with some of the migrant. Because it seems to me that's the hardest thing. It's sort of like your base load in energy. You have a certain base load of permanent working poor, but then you also have this variance that goes on, and I'm trying to figure out how that fits into all of this.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, the 1999 legislature formed a farm worker housing task force, 2000, chaired by Representative Mannix and Senator Ferrioli, and came up with, I believe it was 18 recommendations for changes. And most of those recommendations were adopted, and there were some tweaks to land use that took us kind of in that direction, but didn't really accomplish what we needed to accomplish, because there was a lot of sensitivity about trying to change the land use laws in a way that would not be abused by those trying to site temporary housing. So it's been looked at. It's become incredibly complicated, as Martha was talking about. It used to be, when I started 15 years ago in the business, I used to be able to go to one federal agency and deal strictly with them and maybe one state funding source. Now we have 10 to 15 funding sources on every project. So it's become incredibly complicated. The federal government has reduced funding in many of their programs and have basically turned it over to the state, or they've decided on some of these private, more private market-based solutions using tax credits, using other types of things other than direct subsidies. You don't see, you know, a lot of voucher, you don't see project-based assistance for a lot of these projects like you used to. You're seeing it coming back a little bit, but not in any real way. You know, growers, and we looked at OSHA regulations. We looked at how those were being enforced. because we saw a lot of farmers that were getting out of the on-farm housing business because they didn't want to deal with all of the OSHA regulations, the BOLI regulations, et cetera. I mean, we took a pretty comprehensive look and to try and figure out the best way to deal with the issue. And I think, you know, we came up with some good funding sources. We came up with better ways for the for different state agencies to work better with the federal agencies. So there were changes that were made, but I think some of the fundamental changes that maybe you're talking about as far as land use didn't get made in the way that maybe we had hoped for.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Krieger, you would not come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Rick Krieger. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. Mr. Chairman, I know you and the committee are very busy today and have a variety of items, so I'm going to just cut to the chase. I essentially agree with everything that the partners just provided to you. I mean, there is certainly a big issue in the state of Oregon as it relates to preservation and manufactured dwelling park. We as an agency are doing everything we can to provide opportunities that would enable us to deal with these particular issues. Through Senate Bill 984, it does allow us to then go out and potentially preserve these very important pieces of affordable housing. So I wanted to appear today to just lend my support to Senate Bill 984 and provide any additional input or answer to questions that you might have specific to the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. I will say that we have been very successful over the years. Since 1989, when this fund was created, we've been able to create approximately 9,000 units of affordable housing, and that's with an allocation of about $31 million, and that's within our current $11 million cap that we've been able to do that. Again, with providing these opportunities with manufactured dwelling parks and preservation, we would, with the increase that is being referred to the $13 million and then essentially to the $15 million after fiscal year 2008, we would be able to provide additional opportunities, not only meet our current need, but also provide additional opportunities for manufactured dwelling parks as well as preservation.
Thank you, Mr. Krieger. Have you have we pretty well always pushed up against the cap each year?
Mr. Chairman, good question. We did have the cap. It was increased last session from $6 million to $11 million. So we are in the stages now of being able to allocate $31 million. So we're in the process of moving towards that $11 million. So it enables us to be able to meet our current need of business. At this point, we believe that within the $11 million, we'd be able to continually allocate $31 million of loans on a biennial basis. But again, with the expansion, we could go even further in the areas of manufactured parks and preservation of the federal subsidized projects.
Yeah, the legislature has worked on a number of fronts over years with the manufactured park dilemma, and you know, starting with you know, trying to help residents be able to purchase parks, and then the next issue, which this is part of, which addresses, is you know, well, then how do you go out and do it? How do you raise the capital for it? I think expanding this this existing program to that, as well as, and I am supportive of the amendment too, to keep the ones that are affordable housing units that that we currently have in use, to try and retain those, is certainly advantageous. But I think really moving them towards the parks is another tool that would you know, provide access to capital that might otherwise be, you know, more difficult to achieve.
Mr. Chairman, I absolutely agree, and again, to the preservation issue, and I recognize exactly what you said. With we've looked for a variety of tools that we can use to help the manufactured dwelling parks. In terms of the preservation, I think Martha had mentioned it. I mean, just in our portfolio alone of our federally subsidized project, or Section 8, so our project base, we're looking over 4,000 units that are going to begin expiring between now and 2013. That's housing that provides for the very lowest income and many that needs have special needs. So recognize obviously the manufactured park issue and preservation is going to very very much be an issue for us as we go forward.
Yeah. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Krieger? I understand it's a big day for you.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is.
You don't look a day over 39.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
40 isn't all that bad. I wouldn't mind revisiting that. Okay. Thank you very much. For the moment, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 984, and when our members return, we'll move this bill along. Okay. Well, actually, a member has just returned, so I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 984 and ask for a motion to move the Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Montes Anderson.
I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 984.
Senator Montes Anderson has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 984. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And again, this bill is a referral to Finance and Revenue.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 984 as amended to Finance and Revenue.
Senator Montes Anderson has moved Senate Bill 984 as amended to the Committee on Finance and Revenue. Any objection? All right, so ordered. I'll let Senator Deckert and Senator Starr work on it over there. Thank you very much for bringing this bill before us today. Okay. Now, speaking of lending, we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 965, and we have a Dash 1 amendment, which is basically the bill now. It's the gotten stuff of the bill. So, and I know we just received this morning, so we're going to get a lot of testimony on to try to help walk us through this. But, Janet, why don't you give us the brief overview, because I know it's complex, and we have other people who will do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to walk through all the provisions of the bill, but in the Dash 1 amendments, the bill basically prohibits certain home lending activities, defines a category of loans of high-cost home loans that are defined in the bill, and the amendments also create a new category of rate spread home loans and places specific conditions on those loans. The staff measure summary, as well as some of the testimony, will run through what the prohibitions are for high-cost home loans and the rate spread home loans. Mr. Chair, there will be testimony about the home loan foreclosures and some of the high-cost techniques that are on home borrowers now. And I also wanted to point out, as some of the testimony will, that the Department of Consumer and Business Services does currently enforce the Federal Trade Commission's Home Ownership and Equity Protection Act, and some of the provisions are similar to these provisions. But as my understanding, those provisions do not apply to state chartered banks unless it's in state statute. So that there will, again, be testimony on that. So.
Okay, and we'll have Senator Bakken here shortly, but let's ask the department, Corey, David, if you want to come forward to begin our testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is David Tapman, Administrator of our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to address some of the issues surrounding high-cost mortgage lending. I'd like to provide you with just a little bit of background on mortgage lending and some of what we've been doing at the department level, and then offer a few comments on the bill. And I will say I just received the Dash 1 amendments when we walked into committee today, so I'm primarily going to be addressing the sort of general concepts rather than the specifics of either the original bill or the Dash 1 amendments. As you probably know, residential mortgage lending can take on many forms. There's the sort of classic example of a first mortgage to buy a house. But then there's also the refinance of a first mortgage. So replacement of your first mortgage with another first mortgage, either to get better terms or take money out in terms of borrowing against your additional equity. You might also take out a second mortgage, a home equity line of credit, or a home equity loan on an installment basis. And mortgages and home equity loans are available through a wide variety of financial institutions, banks and credit unions, which could be federally chartered or state chartered, mortgage companies or consumer finance companies. And some of these institutions primarily offer loans at the high end of the market to people with good credit. Others offer loans primarily to those with blemished credit or with little credit history, and those are in the so-called subprime market. And we have heard quite a bit about subprime lending recently at the national level as well as here in Oregon. The past few years have been very active in the real estate and lending markets here in Oregon. There's been a favorable low interest rate climate. There have been rapid increases in appreciation in home values. And so that's created a market in which many people have been able to buy a home. Many people have refinanced loans. Many people have taken out home equity lines of credit to draw down on their equity. And the industry's been creative in developing a number of new different types of loan products aimed at either allowing people to get into a home or to, again, draw down that equity. And those include adjustable rate mortgages, sometimes with substantial balloon payments or substantial increases later on, depending on the interest rate climate, as well as loans with flexible payment terms, which may include interest-only payments for a period of time, or even negative amortization loans where your initial payments do not even pay the interest, so that your equity actually shrinks rather than growing, unless the appreciation in the home value is big enough to grow faster than that. And these non-traditional loan products primarily or particularly in the subprime market do, of course, pose significant risks to homeowners, particularly if interest rates go up or the home market slows, because in that case, a homeowner could find themselves facing a very substantial increase in payment structures. They could find that they, in fact, do have negative equity in the home, and some of these loans have very significant prepayment penalties, so a borrower could find themselves trapped, essentially, in one of these loans that they cannot afford, yet their equity in their home doesn't allow them to refinance, and that's where we see foreclosures. And around the country, we have seen very significant increases in foreclosures, particularly in this subprime lending market in recent times. And fortunately, Oregon has actually fared better than many parts of the rest of the country. But there is still cause for concern, and we have seen increases in foreclosure rates here in Oregon, just as other areas of the country have. But, and in fact, according to some industry sources, a 40% increase in foreclosure rates 2006 over 2005. But the good news is that our overall rates do still remain comparatively low. And the 40% is comparable to other parts of the country, but that represents only one in 152 Oregon households compared to the national average of one in 92 households. And looking at the other states on the West Coast, Washington is one in 129, California is one in 186. So one out of 152 households is relatively healthy, but still each one of those foreclosures can mean a very significant situation for the household involved. Part of the reason Oregon's faring better than some other parts of the country is that we do have a continued strong housing market. We haven't seen a collapse in the housing market. But because we have seen a slowdown and some modest increases in interest rates, we do think that this is a subject that's well worth your attention. And we have been paying attention recently. We want to make sure that Oregon borrowers are fully informed about their options, including whether there are other options available that might be on better terms, that they fully understand the consequences of any loan that they're getting into, and that they are not trapped in a loan that they can't afford. And we began, as the department, focusing pretty heavily on mortgage lending, these mortgage lending issues, increasing our focus a little over a year ago. We held some public forums. We saw a significant increase in complaints about poor practices, false representations of loan products, bait-and-switch type of tactics where the borrower is offered what looks like good terms, but then when they go in to close the loan, the terms are much worse, but they at that point have no option but to go forward. Sometimes even fraudulent practices in terms of fraudulent appraisals or falsification of other loan documents. failure to disclose rates and terms, including things like steep prepayment penalties. So we have taken a number of steps under our existing authority to strengthen regulation and oversight of the mortgage lending industry. We've adopted new rules increasing the education requirements for mortgage professionals, better defining the supervision requirements, and making sure that mortgage lenders are effectively supervising their frontline salespeople, who are known as loan originators. We've stepped up our examination and enforcement efforts, and in common with federal regulators and the state regulators in a number of other states, we've recently issued new guidance for state-regulated lenders issuing interest-only or variable payment types of loans, the type where you may face low payments originally but then steeply increase payments over time, requiring those lenders to consider, when making the loan, the borrower's ability to pay over the life of the loan rather than just their ability to make the initial payments. So that's what we've seen and what we have been addressing. Senate Bill 965 addresses a particular type of mortgage, those which are classified as high cost, as defined by the bill. And as drafted, the bill defines a high-cost mortgage as a first mortgage with an interest rate of at least 7% over the equivalent T-bill rate. For a second mortgage, 9% over the T-bill rate. And treasuries are running about 5% now. So that would be, for a first, for an initial mortgage, 12% or more than 12%, or more than 14% for a second. Or fees and points, with some exceptions, that are at least 5% of the loan amount. So meeting those thresholds makes you a high-cost loan. And then the bill specifies some protections that go into place. And most of those protections are already in federal law, the Federal Homeowners Equity Protection Act, as was mentioned, which is part of the federal truth in lending law. The federal law sets interest rates and fee thresholds at somewhat higher levels. For first mortgages, 8% over the Treasury rate. For second mortgages, 10%. It does not apply to first mortgages for the purchase of a home. It applies to refinances and to second mortgages. So the effect of Senate Bill 965 would be to extend similar protections to a somewhat larger class of high-cost loans. We understand that about half the states have passed state-level lending laws to supplement the federal protections. Many of them are similar to what you see in 965, and they in lowering those thresholds that are imposed by the federal law. For example, North Carolina was one of the first to go that route in 1999. I understand, and you'll probably hear more about this, that Senate Bill 965 is actually modeled on legislation adopted a couple of years ago in New Mexico, and what we hear from those states is that they have actually not decreased the availability of credit, but they have decreased the number of loans that are in this high-cost segment. Some of the protections that would be available to borrowers making these high-cost loans, you'll find some of them in Section 4 of the bill, and again, I'm referring to the printed bill rather than the Dash 4 amendments at the moment. Things like a prohibition on balloon payments, most balloon payments within the first 15 years, a prohibition on negative amortization, a prohibition on prepayment penalties, a prohibition on loan flipping, which is repeated refinancing that doesn't have an economic benefit to the borrower, a requirement that the lender consider the borrower's ability to repay. There's also requirements in the bill for loan counseling and disclosure for people getting into these high-cost loans. I do want to point out that even with the lowered thresholds, still only a relatively small percentage of mortgages, Oregon mortgages, would fall under this bill. We generally don't see first mortgages that are within the thresholds in this bill, although we do see some home equity loans and second mortgages within these levels. One issue you may want to think about is whether the thresholds are at the right level or whether to extend the protections of this type of bill to some additional types of mortgages that pose equally significant risks. And examples might be mortgages with an initial interest-only period or adjustable-rate mortgages that have the potential for very steep increases in a relatively short period of time. Those are the ones that tend to get borrowers into serious trouble. You may also want to look at the ability to repay section, and actually we understand the Dash 1 amendments may incorporate some additional language to require the lender to look at ability to repay not just with the initial payment but over the life of the loan. And again, that's what we are requiring in our guidance, but a number of states have taken the approach of putting that into statute as well. Again, making sure that for someone who gets into one of these loans, they are not getting in over their head. One additional point I wanted to bring to your attention is that under federal law, we cannot regulate lending practices of national banks and national credit unions, those who choose a national charter instead of a state charter. And there's a dual chartering system for banks and credit unions. A bank or a credit union can choose to be registered at the state level or the federal level. At the state level, we have regulatory authority over the other types of mortgage lenders, not only the state chartered institutions, but also mortgage lending companies and consumer finance companies. Many national banks have state subsidiaries that engage in mortgage lending specifically, and those have traditionally been regulated at the state level. But there is a case currently pending before the United States Supreme Court called Waters versus Wachovia Bank, which brings into question whether states can regulate mortgage subsidiaries of national banks. And depending on the outcome of that case, which we're likely to find out in the next few months, it's possible that the scope of our state regulation could be narrowed. But we do nevertheless think that it's important to have a good, solid state regulatory program to protect Oregon borrowers, because a fair amount of the industry will still be subject to state regulation regardless. We really appreciate the time you're taking on this issue. A purchase of a home and financing of a home is often the most significant financial transaction that an Oregonian will ever make. And the consequences can range from successful home ownership to financial disaster and foreclosure. And so we do think that Oregon is positioned now to take some steps that can prevent us from experiencing some of the real tragedies that we've seen elsewhere in the country. So thank you, and both David and I will be happy to respond to any questions that you have.
Thank you, Ms. Streisinger. I will have a couple questions, but I'm going to ask Senator Avakian, who has arrived, to come forward first and give us his opening remarks after your opening remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I'm actually very glad that I'm sorry I kept the committee waiting, but I'm very glad that Ms. Reister had a chance to go first, because she gave you a very good overview of what the bill can accomplish in Oregon. And what I really wanted to do was give you more of a conceptual reason for the bill as to the specifics. Other people will fill you all in on the specific provisions of the bill. And the big picture is the big picture, and the need for it is something like this. There really is little else in life that creates such a burden as purchasing a home, especially for young couples or for families, and especially today where people are more and more hanging on a shoestring. The need to refinance, to need to purchase your home with one of these new types of products that is available to you, is more enticing to folks than it has ever been before. And for more and more people, they're in the worst possible position to be doing these types of things. And the state currently doesn't have much in the way of protection for these folks, which stands the risk in our state of many people hanging on the edge of foreclosure, which is not where we want our young folks and our families, let alone anybody else. The reason that we've come to this point is because over the last 5 years or so, there has been a significant change in the mortgage lending industry. Now, your traditional loans that have been given by the banks, those are continuing, and this bill doesn't address those. But these other loans, which some people are referring to as exotic loans, that are loans that have various types of variable interest rates, or they've got a huge balloon payment at the end, don't require substantial down payments, don't require the same kind of financial checks that the traditional banks do. These are the kind of loans that we're talking about in this particular bill. Recently, Congress has issued new guidelines for these non-traditional, what we call also subprime loans, that applies to banks. And that provides some protection at the national level. But what we need in Oregon is we need a standard that applies to the state-licensed non-bank lenders, which are the ones that are generally putting out these types of products, and that is the reason for 965. It's timely because even though the nation as a whole is not continuing in some places to see high home values like we're seeing here, they're still high in Oregon. And as I look up at the dais in every one of your districts, actually, of some of the highest valued, highest priced homes now, which forces folks that are purchasing these homes over to some of these types of products. So it's a timely bill for Oregon. It's an important bill because it covers something that the federal legislation does not cover, and it's something that will be a great benefit to many new families that are out there. With that, I will end, and I thank you very much for allowing I and Senator Brown, who is co-sponsoring the bill with me, to have a chance to have it before your committee.
Thank you, Senator Rockin. Corey, you mentioned that you were getting more complaints about lending practices, some of which are maybe covered in this legislation, some of which are not. But in terms of a litmus test of where we are in terms of the market and what some of these things may address, what is the level of that? I mean, what are the have you noticed a significant uptick on that? And maybe we get an idea of the health of the industry in terms of how it's dealing with the borrowers.
Mr. Chair, we have seen a significant uptick in complaints, and I want to make clear that many participants in the mortgage lending industry do an outstanding job and are very upstanding and don't engage in any of the types of practices that give us grave concern. But there are others who do engage in very aggressive and sometimes inappropriate tactics. We have seen an increase in the volume of complaints, and we have stepped up our efforts accordingly. David, I don't know if you've got any specifics you can add.
I do, Mr. Chair. A good example is David Tatman, yes, with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. A good example would be one out of Yamhill County about 24 months ago. There were seven individuals that were licensed as mortgage lenders that were ultimately charged with criminal charges, and I think six of them were convicted, involving a number of things that Corey just listed, including misrepresentation of terms, misrepresenting the nature of the loan that the borrower would get, and then at the time of closing they found out that was not what they were getting, changing or falsification of the materials needed to obtain the loan from the ultimate lender, say a bank somewhere else. That kind of practice is, as Corey said, is not widespread, but we see that often enough that we have concerns. We have probably aggressively increased the number of examinations we needed to do, and while the examinations show that many people are doing a good job, we're starting to also find that there are a number of people that don't understand the products they're offering, and we think this is helpful. Now, this covers a certain strata of the lending practices, not all lending practices, but I think this is a good place to start.
Well, I guess that would be my next question, is that I think it would be fair to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I would call our AAA rated lending organizations, our credit unions, our national and state chartered banks, people that are very visible and conform. I don't hear of those types of things with U.S. Bank or anything like that. But there's a lot of people, as you have indicated, who are involved in the lending industry that are maybe less than the AAAs that we're talking about that we're trying to get at. It would be helpful to me if you could just kind of give me a brief picture of who the types of lenders that provide these types of mortgages that this would cover that we're really kind of looking at. I mean, because I don't want people to think, we're we got our regular community banks and credit unions are probably not the ones I know we're after here, but maybe give me an idea of who are these industry folks that we're most concerned about.
Mr. Chair, I would concur exactly with what you said. The banks and the credit unions, if you will, we use phrasing of A paper, B paper. A borrowers, B borrowers. There's a whole strata of different borrowers based on their credit history, based on the circumstances, based on their earnings. And the banks and credit unions, for the most part, have the luxury of being able to work with the people that are at the A level, and the interest rates reflect that. And so you're not going to see the types of loans that are reflected in Senate Bill 965. We're talking, then there are others that will engage in providing subprime loans, and those are loans that are not A and B, but are still loans that we think are ones that people are capable of repaying, but they're going to charge a little bit more for that loan. But to get to that area where 965 addresses it, we're talking about people that are going to be at the lowest echelon of lending. Maybe they've had significant credit problems in the past. Maybe these kind of exotic loans that we just heard about from Senator Vakian are the only ways they can get into the housing
market. I guess
market.
Where I'm trying to ask, who are the providers of these loans? I understand the clientele.
Well, the providers would be our mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers in the state of Oregon. There are a lot of people that do this through the Internet, and they're licensed with us as mortgage bankers. They may not be physically here, and they're offering rates through mortgage brokers. The brokers act as independent brokers for numerous bankers, and they'll supposedly go out and get the best deal they can find for a client. The other would be our consumer finance lenders. They do a lot of real estate lending, a lot of home equity loans, the HELOCs, if you will, and open-ended lines of credit secured by real estate. And they're the ones that are going to be people that didn't qualify for banks and credit unions are going to turn to them that maybe to get that loan at a higher rate. And our analysis has been that when people are engaged in secondary loans and are going to consumer finance companies because they can't get it somewhere else, they are bumping into these interest rates. So that's where we're going to see it. It was with the consumer finance companies predominantly and with some of our mortgage lenders.
If I could just add, yeah. Mr. Chair, there are also, one of our concerns is people who actually could qualify for a much better loan, but they are reeled in, if you will, by unscrupulous marketing practices. Some of these have just crossed my desk in the last few weeks. Someone who has a mortgage, they have a good credit rating and it's a good mortgage, and they will get a pitch which looks like it's from their existing mortgage company. It will have the existing, XYZ bank, and it will say, "Dear so-and-so, we've been trying to XYZ Bank, loan reference number XYZ. We've been trying to contact you regarding a potential increase in your loan payments. We have several options to offer you that will reduce your payments, but we've been unable to reach you. Please call this 800 number so that we can keep you from getting a loan increase." And then in print that's so small I can't read it with a microscope, at the foot of the page it will say "not affiliated with XYZ Bank." And it's a pitch for a new loan with potentially high fees. It's from one of these mortgage lenders that is operating in this subprime market. But for an elderly person, for example, or someone who's not as sophisticated at analyzing marketing pitches, it's going to sound like it's from their bank and it's going to save them money and they're going to sign up.
Yeah. And this bill, does this bill make that illegal?
We have authority right now to regulate misleading advertising, and we have some enforcement action that we're looking at in those areas.
You don't need this bill.
This bill would not specifically address advertising. What it would do is protect the borrowers who say yes and sign on the dotted line for those loans.
There, sir.
Well, my question is along the lines of Senator Deckert's. I mean, you mentioned the seven folks out in Yamhill County. Well, you're able to prosecute those without the benefit of this bill. Why do we need this bill if you already have the tools to go after these folks when they're doing things that aren't up and up?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, we'd actually, the goal, I think, is to have people go into these with their eyes open. And we can take care of people who engage in illegal conduct after the fact. Some of these are legal activities. It's just that the borrower going into them doesn't know. The disclosure is poor, and they don't understand that, in fact, the initial payment is not what the payment's going to be a year from now or 5 years from now. The bill would not prohibit those loans. It would require different types of disclosure, and it would prohibit some types of payment terms that can be abusive. So it would, for people who are making those high-interest loans, we think it would prevent some practices which tend to trap people now. And we have, incidentally, heard, we actually held a public forum to get feedback, and we heard quite a few people come in and say, "I didn't understand that this loan would escalate this way, and I particularly didn't understand that it would have a huge prepayment penalty, and now I can't get out."
May I ask a dumb question?
Well, go ahead.
Dumb ones,
yeah, go ahead. You're welcome.
You could have said you do it often.
I was being kind.
So, Corey, generally bills like this, and I may have missed your prelude, generally they come from groups that are, if it's a comprehensive bill like this dealing with lending practices, they tend to have groups that have met over and over through the interim, hammering out difficult, and perhaps I missed it. Is this the product of
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Deckert? This is not our bill. The answer to that question is no. This is based on legislation that has been adopted in a number of other states. And so we were not involved in drafting this bill. We were asked to take a look at it after it was drafted and give comments on it. And my comments are aimed more at the sort of big picture of what's going on at mortgage lending than the specifics of this bill.
Okay. Other questions? Senator George?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to find it in the bill, and during your testimony, you talked about basically prohibiting certain types of loans, and one of those was, I think, the reverse equity type. In the bill and in the dash ones, is there a prohibition on certain types of loans? I don't have any problem with information, but actually prohibiting loans makes me very nervous.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I believe that for these high-cost loans, one of the prohibitions in the bill is to prohibit negative amortization provisions. And I'm just looking for that in Section 4. I'm just looking at the dash ones. A high-cost home loan may not contain a payment schedule with regular periodic payments to cause the principal balance of the loan to increase.
I got you. I see it now. Follow up. A lot of people use these as a cash flow tool, understanding the risk that's involved. So I guess I'm a little nervous about going forward and actually prohibiting things that, for a lot of people, I actually didn't go through with it, but I was looking at a real estate transaction where I needed cash flow on another business that I was doing and was going to use a tool like that to get through cash flow purposes. And it seems like to me it's completely legitimate business risk that you could, or personal risk if you want to use some of those tools, as long as you're fully aware of what you're getting into. So I'm just asking what the department's kind of view, I guess, is that.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator George, it's my understanding that the substantive provisions of this bill were taken wholesale from the federal law. So those substantive provisions simply mirror what's in the federal law, but extend the types of loans to which those prohibitions would apply.
If I may add, Vice Chair Senator George, I think the focus of the bill is a certain class of people at a certain interest rate, and the federal government has looked at these people and probably have made a determination that they're not in a position to do what you're describing, whether they're in a bridge loan situation or whether they're making a short-term cash flow analysis, and then they're going to get out of it. I think they're looking at the cost to themselves for a certain period of time and not looking beyond to what happens when that computation occurs in a year, 2 or 3 years. And I think that's the concern, is that, yes, this is legitimate, and it would be available for people here in this room for the most part. I think it's not going to be available under this bill, and it's already not available under the federal law for certain classifications.
All right, good. One last thing, Mr. Chair. I guess the frustration I have here is that there's a big difference between protecting people from predatory practices where people are being deceptive. I felt like I was in one of those situations myself where somebody just flat out lied to me and it closed and I had to walk away. I mean, I've done that before. So I understand that probably for a lot of people it'd be hard to walk away from that. So I understand the need for predatory issues. On the flip side of that, though, I'm not sure it's necessarily the role of us to stop people from just being stupid either. I mean, people sometimes decide they want to go out and buy cars. You could apply this to all kinds of purchases, credit cards. Mm-hmm. I mean, people make all kinds of ridiculous purchases in their lives that make no financial sense to me whatsoever. And I'm not sure how far I can go in down that track. I mean, if somebody's being deceptive, I'm with you. Let's crack down on that. But if we're just saying we're going to protect this class of people from making a decision that we don't agree with. I really find that a little bit difficult for the role of the state to go, and it seems to be a departure from what the policy sort of been, if you discuss that.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator George, it's a very legitimate issue as to how far the state should go, and should we focus on the information and the disclosure and the counseling and the making sure that people walk into these transactions with their eyes open, or should we say that some types of transactions at some costs are inherently abusive? And very legitimate issue, and there may be other witnesses who are going to address some of what they're seeing in that regard.
Thank you very much.
Other questions?
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Sandy Hallinan, Angela Martin, and Rick Bennett, you want to come forward and please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
I'm Sandy Hallinan with Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation and the Oregon Homeownership Alliance. Thank you very much, Chairman Metzger and the committee. I am here because I am an advocate for homeowners, and I work with primarily low-income, first-time home buyers. And Neighborhood Economic Development Corporation, NEDCO, was founded in 1979. I've been there since 1994. And in that 13 years, we have developed our homeownership program. We do a lot of homeownership education and counseling, and we also are a developer of affordable homes. In that period of time, we've built about 130 homes, both rehabs and new construction for low-income first-time home buyers. We've also worked with about 15,000 families who are hopeful homeowners, and I can't tell you exactly how many of those have become homeowners, but probably something in the order of 80 to 100 per year using our programs. I want to say that the question that people ask the most often when they come to ask us, they're very hopeful about becoming homeowners, and the most important question and the main question they ask is, can I have a dog? And the reason they ask that question is because homeownership means having the things they have never had in their life before. It's an extremely emotional point of their life. It means success for their families and for themselves. And in that very emotional state, they can easily be taken advantage of. They can easily not ask the right questions. And they can very easily be convinced to do things that don't make sense. We know that they're easily convinced to do things like don't take that home buyer education class because it's not a good thing. We know that they can be convinced not to use government-sponsored down payment assistance programs and loan programs. That's why those programs don't get used as much as they used to be used. Man, we have money waiting in those pools. We know that they can be convinced of things. They can be convinced to take out a mortgage where they really have no money left over for their food. They can be convinced of all these things. And unfortunately, we see those people both before they buy their homes, but when it's too late, and after they buy those homes and they're in foreclosure and can't make the payments. The other thing they can be convinced to do, and this is very distressing to us, is they can be convinced in the case of people who are undocumented to commit fraud by filling out their forms saying that they are citizens. And in this case, they're the ones at risk and not the loan officer. So as a homeownership organization, we see a lot of things when the people come to us when they can't make their payments. And they say a lot of things to us. They say, I had no idea that this payment was going to go up like this. They say things like, I had no idea they'd give me this loan if they didn't think I could pay. I thought they would only give it to me if they knew I could pay, and I trusted them. And now I can't pay. They say things like, I only make $1,600. I'm a dishwasher. But on the loan application, they put that my income was $35,000. And when I asked them about it, they said, it's just a formality. It doesn't really make any difference. That's the small stuff. You're going to get the loan. Isn't that what you really want? They didn't know that their property taxes and insurance weren't included in their loan. They just didn't know it. Why didn't they know it? Sometimes they weren't given the information. Sometimes they were so emotional. Sometimes it was in the fine print. But they didn't know it. And that's the issue. They didn't know it. So they get into all kinds of things, and it's not sustainable. One of the things is, as a homeownership organization, I do a lot of reading, and I read the newspapers every day, and I read the defaults every day. One of the things that's happened in the last 2 or 3 years is that many, many, many of those default notices are defaults where the loan is less than a year old. Now, that's very distressing. This isn't about a person who got into a loan and was able to sustain it for a long time. This is about somebody who got in, maybe didn't even make the first payment. So as I mentioned, we as a homeownership organization have actually developed 130 homes, and we have several more that are in the process. Of those 130 homes, all of those were sold to low-income first-time home buyers. There has not been a single foreclosure on those homes. There's a reason there hasn't been a single foreclosure of all those homes. Those are homes that people have owned them for 15 years. So why? It's because we make sure that they get pre-purchase education. We make sure that they have dealt with any kind of credit issues they have. We make sure they know how to do budgets and how to save, how to prepare for the unexpected. We make sure they're getting an affordable home, which, because we build them, they're affordable. We make sure that they get into a loan that has fair terms and a fair interest rate. And we also make sure that they put in a small cash down payment from their resources. We also know that with working with these families, they can learn how to save money. They can't save a lot because they don't have a lot, but they can do that. So one of the things that happens is that we know that people can get into loans and can become successful. What's happened in the last several years as the market has increased is that there is this home buyer fever. You better hurry up and buy right now, because if you don't, you'll never be able to buy, and you got to start building equity right now or else you can't get into the market. And people are getting into a lot more loans, which, frankly, if any homeownership counselor working for a nonprofit would have talked to them, we would have said, hold it, whoa, wait. Let's talk about your budget. Let's read what the terms are. Let's try to save some money. Let's make sure you're stable before you get into that loan. Now, of course, not everybody is going to listen to us. We know that. But a lot of people do, and I think a lot of times they just don't have the confidence. When they get to closing, they know something's wrong, but they don't have the confidence to say, well, no. They just say, well, I've got to do it. This is my one opportunity. And if I don't do it now, my family isn't going to be happy. What we've heard a lot about is that these new subprime products are called affordability products. And they're called affordability products because you can't get into this loan, but we could get you into this one. And you'd be able to get in, and we can make it affordable. It's kind of like a car lot thing. You know, what do you want to pay? Here's what we can give you. And that's not necessarily sustainable. But we hear that that's what's going on. And, of course, I think, Senator George, you ask, who are these lenders? In our communities, we know who they are. You know, we know who these people are. And because they come to us, we see the results of it over and over and over again. So I think what I am here to say is that we do need to have some safeguards. I really, of course, like the provision that people who are looking and considering these types of loans are required to talk to a homeownership counselor, somebody who is a disinterested party or is only their advocate, somebody who's not making money on the deal, because we can get them to slow down and make sure they really do understand what the terms are. I think I would say, bottom line, that the homeownership is really an American dream. And it means that people have achieved something many times that they thought they could never achieve. And we just really have to safeguard as much as possible that it's not a tragedy. It really is still a dream. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Starr, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Angela Martin, and I'm here representing Our Oregon. Today I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 965 and in support of policies that will increase protections for Oregon's homeowners. We've been hearing in the news from folks who've testified that there's an urgent need to curb some of the abusive lending practices that are harming home buyers. Harming families across the United States and here in Oregon. We've been somewhat shielded in Oregon from the brunt of the foreclosures that we're witnessing in other states, but that's not due to last. Let me share with you some of the statistics. In Portland metropolitan area, an estimated 20% of subprime loans that originated in 2006 are at risk of foreclosure. For the Salem area, that figure is 18.5%. Medford, 19.2%. Eugene, 18.8%. These are the number of loans, subprime loans, that are at risk of foreclosure, and just the loans that were taken out last year. Again, while the high housing prices have so far buffered Oregon homeowners, it is a false security. We can and must take action to prevent further lending abuses while taking action to soften the blow for families who are already in these unaffordable products. The subprime market is intended to serve families with low incomes, fluctuating employment histories, or credit problems. And they are not inherently abusive products. Quite to the contrary, subprime lending has afforded the opportunity for many families to obtain that American dream of home ownership. But those loans must be done with full consideration of the consumer's protecting that asset the consumer is getting into. Expanding access to home ownership is without a doubt one of the best ways to help families acquire wealth and economic security. However, no one would advocate for temporary home ownership or foreclosures. That's not helping families, certainly not helping communities. Not long ago, subprime lending was a small niche market. Nationally, the market has grown from $35 billion in 1994 to a total of $665 billion in 2005. Again, to give you a sense of how much of the market this is consuming, nationally in 2006, subprime market represented 23% of all mortgages taken out. In Oregon, we hold the distinction of being one of the highest-ranked states for some of the non-traditional mortgages that are at the highest risk for foreclosure. Interest-only mortgages and negative amortizing mortgages. In 2005, about a third of Oregon mortgages were interest-only, not just subprime, a third of Oregon mortgages. And after the first quarter of 2006, we find that 9.4% of Oregon mortgages were negatively amortizing loans. As I mentioned before, the experience of high foreclosure rates for families may be slower here, but we can't allow that to slow us down in taking some action to prevent the damage that can be done. Let me talk a little bit about some of the products that we see as the most risky. Risky loans constitute loans that do not take full consideration of a borrower's ability to pay the full length of the loan. I provided a graph that I'd like you to take a look at that really explains the problem for me. The graph here shows what a typical 28-2 or exploding arm loan looks like. This is one of the most prevalent types of subprime loans. In this example, the family qualified for this loan based on the initial teaser rate. For the first 2 years, their monthly payment was going to be $1,311 per month. After that initial 2 years, when their mortgage reaches the full index rate, their payment jumps to $1,948. This is leaving the family $210 a month to pay for groceries, childcare, transportation, all of life's expenses. This typical family is going to have very few options left. They can refinance and pull out the equity that they hopefully built up over the last 2 years of their loan. They can sell their home and cut their losses, or they can hold on with all their might and eventually face foreclosure because they're simply not going to be able to survive with that $210 per month. One of the provisions of Senate Bill 965 would take this into consideration by requiring that lenders consider the ability of the borrower to pay the full price of the loan when it reaches that top rate. Other risky products and concerns we see is with broker abuses. Current market practices create an incentive for brokers to ignore the best interest of the borrowers. Bonuses for selling loans with higher interest rates and the lack of accountability due to the fact that loans are sold to investors soon after the origination provide little incentive for the broker to consider the performance of the loan over the life of the loan. Nationally, studies indicated that minority borrowers are more likely than non-Hispanic whites to be steered into these high-priced subprime loans, and this is regardless of their credit and income status. We find that happening here in Oregon. In Oregon, statistics show us that African Americans are 3.5 times more likely than non-white Hispanics to be steered or to be taken out a subprime loan. So these figures are truly troubling in terms of broker abuses. Take a second to look at some of the solutions offered in 965. Again, mentioned that considering the borrower's ability to pay, prohibit some of the features that create payment shocks, forcing borrowers to refinance or sell, including negative amortizing loans and large balloon payments. One of the additions that we'd like to offer to 965 is to establish a fiduciary duty for all lenders and brokers involved with the loan. Everyone that touches the loan as the lender should have a fiduciary responsibility to that borrower. Also, call again your attention to the process of steering. We believe 965 would be strengthened if we add provisions that would prohibit brokers from steering borrowers who would otherwise qualify for a prime loan or a less expensive loan into some of these high-cost loans. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I believe the solutions offered in Senate Bill 965 will help protect families from some of those worst abuses in the subprime lending market.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. A disclosure or two. AARP, we did not request this legislation, but we have developed a model state statute that's Home Loan Protection Act, which I understand is the basis for at least part of this bill. And upon the introduction of the bill, we provided additional comments, some of which that I believe have been incorporated into the -1 amendments. Second disclosure I'd like to make is the fact that I'm not in any way a knowledgeable or expert type in this area, and so my comments are going to be general, and I hope if you have any specific questions, you'll allow me a little time to talk to an expert and get back to you with an answer. With that, it should be come to no surprise that AARP supports Senate Bill 965. Predatory lending practices are a subject of great concern to our members. I think it's been fairly well identified. The key problem related to these lending practices is the unsustainable loans made through the predatory lending practices, and particularly our older citizens. They tend to own their homes outright or have a very high percentage of equity in them, and this makes them a prime target for unscrupulous lenders who seek to relieve them of as much of this equity as possible. AARP is concerned about the current combination of minimal underwriting standards and, as mentioned, the exotic and complex mortgage products that are out there right now. Angela Martin has already given a couple of examples related to the types of products we're talking about. such as the 228s or 327s, which offer a low interest rate for 2 or 3 years, and then the interest rate increases dramatically over the remaining 28 or 27 years of a mortgage, interest-only mortgages, and then the adjustable rate mortgages, some of which are promoted with a 1% teaser rate that typically applies only to the first month of a mortgage, and then again, dramatically increases after that. To the extent that lenders underwrite the income supporting these loans at all, they do so based on only the rather deceptively low payments calculated at the low initial rate, and not on the payment that will be charged when the loan becomes fully amortized, and certainly not on the maximum rate that could be charged over the life of the mortgage. Also, these mortgages become a trap from which many homeowners never escape. The 5-year prepayment penalties, often the norm for these mortgages, make it impossible for homeowners to refinance out of or otherwise avoid the complex series of payment shocks built into these mortgages. That trap can be fortified by a downturn in housing prices. And as mentioned, we're not there yet, but certainly this is being experienced in other parts of the country, and I wouldn't suggest that Oregon is immune from that in the future. Homeowners have been able to escape foreclosure by repeatedly refinancing, but once that equity is eaten up, that's no longer an option, and foreclosure is the only act left. These predatory loans strip equity from hardworking Oregonians and set them up for failure. We believe Senate Bill 965 is a strong step forward in eliminating predatory mortgages and allowing consumers to preserve their status as homeowners. This bill fosters the development of a fairly priced subprime loan market. A couple of specific comments related to questions. I think Corey indicated that federal laws to some extent cover these issues, but I think we should consider the federal laws as a floor and not a ceiling, a floor that in fact we can build additional protections for our citizens onto. And the other comment I'd like to make is, is it indeed? Can we protect everyone from anything that's out there? No. But on the other hand, I don't think we want a state where it's basically buyer beware and anything goes. I think we need to set some parameters. So in fact, what we're protecting or dealing with or making decisions about are fair and reasonable lending practices and not predatory in nature. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm having a little bit of a difficult time kind of figuring out where the problem is. I understand that there are loans that are high cost, puts people in high-risk situations. But for the lenders, it's incredibly expensive to go through foreclosure. I mean, it's an incredibly expensive thing. So is the problem with the mortgage broker? So what you have is you have somebody who is basically falsely selling this to somebody, and then their turnaround is selling it to a bank, and the bank is ending up with a bad situation too. I mean, where is the problem, with the banking institutions or with the mortgage brokers? I guess I'm not quite getting where the testimony is going on this.
I think the problem is with the loan officer, who is paid on a commission basis. When they make the loan, they get paid at that point. And if it goes into foreclosure, it doesn't really make any difference. They don't face any penalty. People sell their loans. Sometimes they sell them to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac or FHA, and sometimes they sell them to investors. Generally speaking, the subprime market is sold to investors, which is a stock market. That's why you see some of the subprime lenders right now, the subprime people who buy the markets, like New Century as an example, going into bankruptcy because the investors saw that their investments were not going to be secure, so because they saw the foreclosures, and so they pulled the funds. So it's really that the issue is with the person who is giving the loan isn't responsible for whether or not the loan succeeds, because they're paid at the front end.
real quickly, but I guess this is just a general statement. I have no problem with disclosure issues. Mm-hmm. My problem is cutting off tools that people can use to get into houses, regardless of how expensive it is. Like I said, I mean, I suppose in a perfect world, I would ban people from buying plasma screen TVs for all kinds of reasons. I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. I'm just saying, it doesn't make any sense to me. But people buy them. I've got one. I don't know why I do. They're incredibly expensive. They burn tons of electricity, and they're not very cost effective. We all do it. But we all kind of make businesses. We all make financial decisions that don't make a whole heck of a lot of sense. And I guess I'm all in favor of more notice and more information and consumers. But at some point, I don't want to shut off opportunities that people could use as a legitimate way, even no matter what the cost is. If they want to do it and they know what the risks are, I'm having a hard time seeing where we insert ourselves in those situations. So I'm with you on the notice and the requirements and prosecuting people who are moving people and baiting and switching, but I'm having a real hard time actually outlawing any specific loans.
If I may, Chair Metzger, Senator George, what I hear you say, the concern I hear you expressing, I do understand. I'm going to back up and say that it starts with the fact that they were never, some loans, some way that they're structured, they were never a tool for home ownership. So let's not ban tools for home ownership, which do include some subprime products. But a product that was sold as affordable, like the graph that I showed you, is not putting a family into a home. It's allowing them to rent it from the mortgage broker for 2 years until they have to sell it back. So let's be careful where we draw the lines, but let's not sell things as tools for home ownership that are not designed that way at all.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We got a couple more people.
Can I ask Angela one question?
Yes.
Angela, just one question on that. So it seems to me, though, on that example, on the graph that you have, isn't the lender going to lose a great deal of money on that? I mean, to me, it seems like the market will correct itself because you make too many of those loans and you're going to get foreclosures and you're going to lose. And even that front office person who was compensated should lose their job for making so many bad loans. So that I'm doing the calibration in my head. I'm thinking they're going to lose money on this and stop making these loans, I would hope. And that was the thought 4 years ago when you saw all this stuff going, you thought.
That's a nice thought. I think that I wish that there would be that checks and balances in. But we've seen the same people in business for a long time.
And they're not losing money on these?
Well, again, I think it's the structure of how they're paid. Now, what is happening now that with some of the subprime investors going out of business, there are fewer places to sell those subprime loans.
Senator Metzger and Senator Deckert, I'd like to provide you with information following this hearing with some of the statistics on how these loans move through the market. Part of the problem is that the original person that I get my loan from, that I take out the subprime loan from, doesn't have a fiduciary responsibility. They don't take the risk 2 years later. They're not anywhere near the loan 2 years from now. So, but I'd like to follow up with your office and get you more specific information.
Great. Thank you. Let's have Renee Ward and Laura Etheron.
Etheron.
Etheron. Welcome.
I guess I'll go first. I'm Renee Ward. I'm actually an employee here for Representative Shields, but I come on a personal matter today before you on behalf of my mother, who is what I've just seen in the paper that I've just seen, the profile that you saw of the graph with regards to the impact of someone taking out a loan unbeknownst to them, uneducated about the process, but in a plight of, because of her health, had to take out a second mortgage on her home. And as a result, in fact, the New Century bank that we've been hearing about, the lender that's currently just filed bankruptcy, was in fact the lender for her. And as a result, our family was devastated with the threat of possibly losing her home after 30-some years in the process of a pre-foreclosure. And as recent as a couple weeks ago, I actually found out about it. Of course, we try to respect our elders, and I did not realize, my sister and I, that she was in this situation. And as a result, we're now working on trying to help her. I've discovered as a consumer and as just a layperson, and fortunately down here, I was able to contact a couple folks like Angela and talked with her about the process and how could my mother get into a situation like this. And as I began to talk with my mom, I found out that she had been misled by information from the lender. Some of the information, in fact, that was handed out to you, as I briefly scanned it before coming out to you, is very much typical of what happened with her and the fact of being misinformed of her options, not understanding of a balloon payment. Very clearly with the graph, it's somewhat her home, I think, is about $280,000, of which to cover medical expenses, three-quarters of her loan has consumed her equity in the home. And as a result, when she tried to make arrangements, which is where I'm concerned and where I see that there's possibly some foul play, as we begin to talk with the lenders and ask them what they would be interested in making arrangements, one of the concerns we had, we talked to about six different people in a matter of 2 days that all stated that they represented in some capacity the interest of that company, and yet no one seemed to have prior record of a conversation by phone. Payment arrangements were made to try to bring her account up to date. And unfortunately, each time that we tried to make arrangements, I'll give you an example, we agreed, oh, well, we'll send in about $3,000 because she's on a fixed income. And she explained to him that, well, is there a possibility of an hardship? That was given as an option to her, yet when we waited for the paperwork, you know, one of the things I found out that the manipulation is time. You can replace money, but you can't replace time. And as a result, time whittled down, and when we waited for her to receive the paperwork, we found out as we called back, well, they had not sent the paperwork. In fact, they didn't have a record of the conversation, and we talked to people all throughout the United States with no paper trail, as it were, electronically on their computer. Then we decided, well, let's find out other options, and I most recently went with her to talk to an attorney to see what options. And atypical, as you know, is the option one, well, do you want to sell the home? Do you want to proceed with possibly the threat of a foreclosure, which for a 69-year-old woman, widow, who this is her investment and looking to give this to her family upon her demise, is no options. That's not recognized in her conversation. So we were looking at a possible refinance, which is where we're at now. But meanwhile, my concern is the fact that I found out that this is not a typical situation. I mean, that it is a routine situation that's happening in Oregon, and I had an opportunity to contact the DC, I think it's the DCBS department, and talking with a man, Mr. Spencer, who came by on his own personal time to talk with me and educate me about what's been happening here in the state of Oregon. And so I come before you today to make a personal appeal as someone who's watched now not only a close family member but others, because I'm also a local pastor in the Portland area. And I am seeing more and more, particularly when you look at the indicators regarding the impact of minorities, the lack of home ownership, the desire for all families to have home ownership, but continually being at the bottom of the food chain, so to speak, of having an opportunity to be educated properly and also be having predators upon our elders and folks who are just looking to keep a livelihood. And so I appeal to you, Chair Metzger, and to the members of this committee to consider very carefully the Senate Bill 965, and I thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Ms. Warden. I think the committee as well would be very interested, if it's possible, to you know, I'd like to hear from DCBS on. I don't know if the director is aware of your particular story at the moment, but I'd like to have more details on that and where that might be in terms of, you know, how that could dovetail with some of the things here, and just as an informational thing, if you're willing to share that. So you might talk to Director Streisinger before we leave, just to kind of exchange numbers, so to speak, because I would like to find out more about your situation.
We've only
got a couple of minutes left, so Laura.
Thank you.
Sorry for butchering your name. I had it written down two different ways here, so.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. My name is Laura Etherton, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 965 today. And I will keep it brief. You've heard most of the details about this issue, and I want to just convey Osberg's support for this bill and make a couple of points. We've been concerned about the increase in a set of practices within the subprime mortgage lending industry, which are leading to increased foreclosures. And while I think good points have been made that we think we're starting to see some of that market correction and some of the natural consequences of these poor decisions in the market, there is such a significant cost to families and to communities when the increased foreclosures go up that it is absolutely appropriate for Oregon to take action to prevent the heartache and to prevent the damage that comes from this increased predatory practices in this industry. I want to point out Oregon, with our housing market not declining as fast yet as we've seen experienced in other parts of the country, have a key opportunity to prevent the worst from happening here, although, as you've just heard, the worst is beginning to happen here, right here in Oregon. And we want to make sure that the default rates that we're seeing of 20 and even 30% by some estimations does not materialize fully here in Oregon. To protect consumers, to protect the stability of our communities, it's critical to add some reasonable limits on mortgage lending. Disclosure is an important piece of that, but also to remove some of the incentives to mislead consumers. And some of that has to do with removing some of the provisions that are in a number of these mortgages. A couple ones I want to point out that you've heard, negative amortization schemes, which when I first learned about these, it's hard to look at a negative amortization scheme and see it as coming close to home ownership. This is a scheme where the borrower pays regularly each month, and that payment gets them further and further in debt. That's a bad rental agreement. That's not home ownership. The consumer has all the liability of the property taxes and the hazard insurance and pays and pays and ends up not with equity and not with a home. This is unconscionable and should not be allowed in any mortgage scheme. The addition of prepayment penalties then can actually trap a borrower in that type of mortgage because they cannot refinance, pay off that awful deal that they've gotten themselves into and get in a new, better situation. And then the final piece of a most egregious example I want to point out is the so-called call provisions in a number of these mortgage arrangements that, on top of negative amortization, on top of a prepayment penalty, sort of the opposite of a prepayment penalty, it allows the lender to say, I know we said that was a 30-year mortgage arrangement, but actually I'd like full payment right now. It allows them to call in the full amount due to them on that loan when they deem it necessary. And as you can imagine, the combination of these predatory practices can send borrowers into quite a debt spiral and trap them there. It's these practices that we think it's completely reasonable to limit when it comes to borrowing in Oregon. We want to make sure borrowers have a full complement of flexible ways to become owners of homes, but that actually makes them homeowners and not folks who are stuck in a worse situation than the one that they started in. So I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill and to thank Senators Avakian and Brown for bringing forward this good legislation that, together with the Dash 1 amendments, should provide some good consumer protections here in Oregon, should protect our communities from the ravages of increasing foreclosure rates, and I urge you to pass this good bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, that's everybody that's set to testify today on the bill. I notice we have a lot of people involved in the lending business who are in the audience who did not sign up. I remember that happened with Senate Bill 408. They figured they just want to sign up, and then didn't turn out to be a very good idea. So we will be bringing this bill back and working the bill, so I would love to hear a committee about this. when we do come back again for any thoughts that were conveyed today. Members, we have a 5 o'clock meeting this evening. We're going to go from 5 to 6:30. I'll make it very clear. We're not going to have these horror meetings I used to hear about that, fortunately, I never had to participate in that would go on and on until 10 o'clock.
Those are Ryan's
committee. Yeah, those, from 5 to 6:30. The first part at 5 o'clock will be we're having a presentation and Mr. Duncan Weiss is putting together on the statewide cost of congestion study, the results that were out. And then we're going to hear about projects of statewide significance, Newburgh-Dundee and Sunrise Corridor until about 6:30. So, any...
Hearing room A.
And we're in hearing room A as in ABLE. Is that your hearing room, A?
As in ABLE.
Yeah, if that's all. Yeah. We'll be in Senator Deckard's hearing room at 5 o'clock. We're here.